It's the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast, where we spend time chatting with expert gardening guests and we ask for their favorite tip. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. Thanks for joining me. Today's guest is Rue C., owner of The King's Roost, an urban mill and cooking school in Silver Lake, California. That's in Los Angeles, by the way, for those of you who don't live here. Rue teaches classes for making sourdough bread, candles, soap, and hosts cooking classes at The King's Roost with guest chefs year-round. Rue also runs monthly-ish, more like 3 weeks, every 3 weeks, bulk buys of wholesale grains and flowers for local Angelenos in the popular meetup group, the Los Angeles Bread Bakers. Thanks for joining me, Rue.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and we're sitting here in your store, which is mercifully air-conditioned right now on a 100-degree day here
it's
in
hot.
Los Angeles. We know each other through LABB, Los Angeles Bread Bakers,
right.
Meetup group. But I first met you and saw this space when I came here to take your 100% whole grain sourdough bread class. And so it's such a beautiful space, and you've got all these gorgeous grains on the wall. Was bread the beginning of the King's Roost for you?
Interestingly, it actually wasn't. When my wife and I moved to LA, I decided to quit my job and sort of let her develop her career.
Uh-huh.
And I was burnt out from corporate. So I stayed home and took care of the kids and started learning various weird skills, including even raising tilapia in the backyard for sushi.
Oh, and were you doing aquaponics?
I was doing aquaponics.
Oh, my God.
And I had a whole, and it, that developed into a whole business where people were coming from all over California to my house to pick up fingerlings, because I figured out how to breed them, and once you figure out how to breed them, they produce an enormous amount of babies.
Wow.
So literally thousands and thousands of baby tilapia have been sold out of my house. I've long since given up on that, but between that and learning magic and doing magic shows for my kids' birthday parties and learning how to make soap and candles, bread just was one of those things that I dabbled in at the time. But what the impetus for the store was just that between that and also we had chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And so between all of those different things, there wasn't any store where I could go get my weird supplies. So
right.
The store kind of became essentially a pantry for all my weird hobbies.
Right. So it had cooking and chickens and soaps and soap making and
aquaponic supplies.
And beer brewing
kits and
right.
cheese making kits and mushroom growing kits. And fast forward, you know, when you took my class, it was a few years ago.
Yeah.
But fast forward, it seems like the milling and the local grains has really resonated with my students and with
yeah.
the community, because it really is such a representation of like how we can sort of take back some of the processes that we've handed over to companies and an industrial process that we can take home very easily again.
Right. And we're going to get a little bit deeper into that
okay.
in a minute. Can you give us a quick tour of the space so that listeners can visualize what's going on here at the King's Roost?
Sure. Well, they could actually follow along because I'm on Google Street View. So
Wait,
if you actually
what?
Take Google Street View, you can actually go from the street and walk in the parking lot and into the store and do like a 360 tour inside the store
How did you walk around.
Somebody just called me and said, we're doing interior Google Street Views for businesses. And I was like, yes, I'll totally do that. So when you first walk in, there is a wall of apothecary jars full of grains. I've got maybe 40 or 50 different grains. They're all different colors. They're all different sizes and all different textures, from wheats to barleys to corn to ancient grains to heirloom grains. Ancient grains mean they have stopped hybridizing them from like ancient times,
right.
and they are the same as they were a long time ago. That's basically what that means. Heirloom and ancient grains are similar in that way. But also some specialty grains and unusual grains, things like amaranth and millet and chickpeas and teff.
I was going to say, do you have teff?
Teff is right there.
I'm seeing, is that the charcoal up on the wall? I'm seeing a black, no, it's not. What is
That's,
that?
That's purple barley.
Purple barley.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, it's beautiful.
It's really great. And I have on my Instagram feed, I have a little loaf of bread that I made with that, which comes out like a light purple, like a velvety purple color. It's really
nice.
Cool.
And do you blend that with other grains?
Yes, because barley has very little gluten.
No gluten. Almost no gluten.
Almost no gluten at all. Not very great for making bread. So you have to mix it in.
Okay. So what is your... I'm diving down this rabbit hole.
Okay, let's get right into it.
What are your percentages or how many grams do you use in a loaf of bread?
Typical bread recipes start with 500 grams.
Okay.
Which... I'm going to digress here for a second. It was pretty funny because I used to sell the grains by the pound.
Yeah.
And bakers kept coming in saying, how many pounds in a 500-gram loaf? And we were constantly doing conversions. And finally, I was like, why don't we just sell the grains in grams? Yeah. So I've actually had some bakers come in and be like, how many pounds is that? So I can figure out how many pounds I need for 500 grams. And then I was like, 500 grams is a loaf of bread. And they're like, oh, yeah.
Right.
So... usually what I do is very simple. For making a loaf of bread, you just want to pick a grain that has enough gluten that you could make a loaf of bread out of it by itself.
Yeah.
So about a third of the grains here, you'd probably do that. And then just use 10 or 20% of that and mix it in with anything you want.
Okay.
So even something that has no gluten at all, you can just, as long as most of the flour in your dough
has some
gluten in it, you should be fine.
So can mix, you can interchange 100 to 200 grams anywhere in there.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, 200 grams would be 40%.
Is it? Oh, because it's five. I'm sorry. I'm used to baking with 1,000 grams, so it's always two loaves. So I'm sorry. Blah.
I'm used to doing 500, that's how I did that math so fast.
Thank you.
So yeah, I usually do like 50 grams of whatever. And it's fun because you can mix anything you want. If you could use purple barley and turn your loaf purple. You can put in corn to give it a sweet flavor. Mm-hmm. You can put in buckwheat to make it soft. You can put in einkorn to make it taste tastier and more bready. You can put in, what else? There's soap and barley to give it almost like a beery flavor. Mm. There's another one that I use sometimes. You know, you can put in a hard red wheat to give it more of like a whole wheat color and a little earthiness. Or you can put in amaranth if you want it to taste like dirt.
So earthy. That's what it does. Yes.
Everything tastes like soil.
Tastes like dirt. It's like how buckwheat, everyone raves about buckwheat pancakes and buckwheat blah, 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 and I think it tastes like dirt, and the honey from buckwheat tastes like horse manure, but don't quote me on that.
That's great.
Anyway, I digress. So we'll come back to this whole great conversation, okay. But continue describing what else is going on.
Okay,
in the store.
So in this sort of roughly three walls of the store, because one wall is a window, the second wall is just all bread supplies and grain mills. That big empty space is where all the grain mills normally are. I've actually sold out of all of my bread grain mills.
Wow.
But I sell the Dutch ovens, the scales, the lams, which are the razor blades for slashing your bread, the proofing baskets, even pizza screens, which I got to go to a pizza store. And I met somebody who owned a pizza store in Glendale in the Las Vegas Bread Bakers Convention.
Oh.
Right, and he's like, oh yeah, I have a pizza place, and you should come check it out. It's in Glendale. I'm like, where in Glendale? I'm like, I know exactly where that is. So I went up there, and I watched them make pizza out of my dough, and it came out tasting like real pizza, but like even better.
Uh-huh.
I realized the trick was, because whole wheat dough, I only use whole wheat,
uh-huh.
because the dough is a little bit fragile, he just built the pie right on the screen.
Oh.
And you just put the whole screen into the oven, you don't have to try and slide it off a peel, which
so
causes
smart.
All home bakers so much consternation.
All the trouble.
There's a little helpful tip for making your pizza really
the screen.
Easy.
And is this, are we talking like a metal dish with the holes in the bottom? That's considered a screen. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
it looks like an air conditioning mesh.
Yeah.
The weird triangle or the little trapezoidal.
Okay.
I'll show you. We'll walk over there and grab one.
Awesome.
So that's the other wall. And then the last wall is just the remaining sort of retail products and chicken supplies from when I used to be entirely retail before I really shifted my focus over to classes.
Classes and education.
Yes.
Well, every time I walk in here, I'm like, I want everything.
Well, the one thing I left out, of course, was in the back is a kitchen.
Yes,
is
you
a
have full
kitchen.
Kitchen.
And it's a home kitchen. That's the key.
It's not a commercial kitchen.
It's not a commercial kitchen. So a lot of times you'll go to a cooking school and you're like, well, great. I don't have all this equipment.
Right.
it is a home kitchen with a home oven that I got from Home Depot and a fridge from IKEA. It's just regular, what you might see in any regular kitchen. And we do all our cooking and classes in that environment.
Now, do you still have, because when I was here, you had the port, it's not portable, it's a countertop oven.
This is a toaster oven.
Toaster oven that has the convection slash steam.
Yes, steam injectors.
Yes. Tell us about that.
Well,
I'm so excited about it.
I know, it's really fun. I used to spend a lot of time, you know, I still do spend a lot of time like reading the bread comment boards and Facebook pages and the groups and all that. And there's always discussion among bread bakers on how to keep the humidity up in your oven. And
yes.
There's all these crazy shenanigans that bakers get up to, like
hot towels,
putting a tray of water in the bottom, or throwing ice into the bottom of your oven, like mm-hmm. into a tray. I've even heard of people heating bricks up on their stove, putting the bricks in the bottom of the oven in a tray, and
then throwing water on it,
yeah. and creating all the steam. And then there's all these side threads of all the people showing pictures of their broken glass windows in their ovens because they spill ice water on a 500-degree piece of glass, which shatters it.
Right.
And I literally was just sitting there, and probably the one thing that kind of defines how I approach my business is I ask the question. I just always ask, why do we do that, and is there a better way?
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of DIY is folklore. It's passed down knowledge. And
yes.
so a lot of it you have to ask, from a scientific or a technical standpoint, why are we doing it this way? So I thought, is there a better way? I mean, somebody must have invented a toaster oven with steam.
Mm-hmm.
So I just Googled toaster oven with steam, and you heard all these bakers around the world talking about how they throw ice cubes into a thing, and they spritz the oven, and and I just Googled it, and up came this Cuisinart toaster oven that has steam injection, and they talk about how for steam roasting, it's wonderful, and oh, by the way, it has a bread function.
Ding, ding, ding.
I was like, oh my God. So I bought like 20 of them. Because I knew the bakers would go crazy.
Gonna sell this.
So I was baking with it, and even like there's a local baker here who I took my first class from, and he's like one of the top 10 artisanal bakers in the United States. And I told him about it. He's like, "What?" He came over with his bread, and we're just standing. The two of us just standing in my kitchen,
just watching it,
his little steaming toaster oven.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So it has a chamber where you pull kind of like a water reservoir off to the side.
You pour
the water in, and then it injects it into at the appropriate time into
exactly. The oven. It's a pre-programmed bread cycle, so it steams for 10 minutes. And then it stops, and then eventually dries out, and then the rest of the cooking cycle is just dry, so that you get the most rise, and you get a nice crust, and because it's a toaster oven, it's really convenient, because if I know I have to leave the house,
mm-hmm.
or if it's really hot out, I'll just toast it, and off I go, and if I forget about it, it doesn't matter, because once it clicks off,
it cools down
very quickly, so right. the bread's not going to burn.
Yeah, and on hot days, you don't want to heat up your whole oven, so the toaster oven's wonderful for that. Yeah.
I have 3 of them in my basement. Sometimes when I have to bake a lot, I just run down to the basement and I plug them in. They're just stacked up in the corner.
I love that. I want to see your basement. You have a basement.
A real actual basement.
Oh, because you're in Glendale.
No, the pizza place is in Glendale.
Oh,
I'm
right.
over in Los Feliz.
Well, okay.
So
yeah, and there are places that have basements in this area.
Not really. It's even in our neighborhood, I haven't seen that many downstairs actual full size. Like, we put our laundry room in there.
Basement.
I have shelves and there's like little windows.
Oh my God. I'm so jealous. I would kill for a root cellar. I really would.
Oh yeah.
So so many things to talk about. We could go off the rails at any point during this interview. All right. Now there's a great photo of you in your kitchen with goggles and gloves on holding what I assume is a thermometer over the sink. What is that all about?
That was soap making.
Okay.
I was mixing sodium hydroxide.
Which is toxic.
Which is corrosive.
Corrosive. Gotta wear goggles.
Yeah. It's not that toxic in that it's the same stuff that you dip bagels and pretzels in.
Okay.
And it's used in cooking, or even what the Aztecs used for creating nixtamalized corn. So
okay.
that's what they would boil the corn in to make nixtamal.
Yes.
Which I think, I'm assuming, is where the word tamal comes from.
I don't know, but that's a very good point.
It's just a guess.
We'll find out from someone eventually.
Someone will tell us. Maybe someone
like,
will comment.
No!
Someone will comment on this
and
give us the real story.
Right.
Someone has a linguistics background. and it's the same ingredient in Drano.
Aha.
But mixing it, when you mix the powder with water, it generates a tremendous amount of heat and steams, and then it stings kind of like when you first open a can of soda and you get that CO2, it mm-hmm. stings a little bit and burns. So that's what I was doing.
Okay. And I imagine that experiments of all sorts like this are going on in your house.
There's all kinds of stuff going on. Weird fermentation stuff. I've got kombucha on the counter. All kinds of weird things like that.
So you've got, you're a homesteader, and you do have chickens. We were talking about that before we started recording. You were telling me a story. I want to try and get a version of this on tape. We don't have tape anymore, but recorded. You said you were, because it gets to be 105 degrees out here or hotter during the summer.
It can,
and people can lose their chickens during that time. So you said you had a van, a purple van.
It's that purple minivan, right?
The purple minivan.
Right up front.
With the seats out in the back and a tarp down, and what was going on inside?
Well, the power went out, so we couldn't bring the chickens into the house. So our house was insanely hot. The backyard was insanely hot. The coop was brand new, so it didn't really have any vegetation on top, which it doesn't. Right now it looks like a hobbit house because it's all green and covered in vines. So the chickens were starting to flag. They were panting and starting to stagger around in circles. They're going to die.
They're going to die. Yeah.
Our chickens are very old. Even at that time, our oldest one, that was 2 years ago, she was 8 years old.
Wow.
And that's her on the wall.
Aw. Hot chicks of 2015.
We made a calendar.
It's a calendar.
Yes, we made a calendar. A pin-up calendar of our hot chicks.
They're so cute.
And so I was like, well, this is survival mode. They're going to die. We need to find air conditioning. But so much valet was out of, had no power. So I was like, I ran to the hardware store, got a tarp, took seats out of my minivan, and taped up a tarp, kind of like Dexterized the inside of my, created like a little killing room. And we transported all the chickens into the back of the minivan, and I just sat in the minivan across the street with the air conditioning on for 2 days.
Oh my God.
We just did shifts. We took shifts. I took most of the day shifts because my wife was working. So I would just sit out front with the air conditioning on. I have to say, it was quite comfortable.
I'll bet.
Because our house was 100 degrees inside.
Ugh.
So, of course, I would just run out occasionally to use the bathroom. And we had neighbors who knew who we were and came by to bring us wine. And I was sitting there drinking. I can't imagine what would have happened if a cop had pulled up to see what was going on.
Yeah, you'd be in jail.
The smell was otherworldly disgusting.
Yeah.
And it took quite some time for my minivan to recover.
Yeah, it's in the towels at that point. I mean,
it was a
no. I mean,
right. But
sorry,
even,
that's a phrase that we use in my house. So now it's in the towels.
It's in the towels. Yes, it was, because I think the smell still got into the upholstery.
Yeah,
and it was pretty gross. In the middle of all of that, keeping in mind we had just moved into the neighborhood, my new neighbor's dog had gotten out. And it was a pit bull.
Okay.
And I didn't know who the pit bull was just running around, was going to get hit by a car. And I'm a total softy for pit bulls. So I open the door to try and see if I can see her collar, knowing that I have a van full of
chickens,
dog food in the back. So I open the door and it's hot. She's freaked out. She's so excited that I'm there. And she's apparently, some dogs are car riders. She dives into my car, into my lap. So now I've got 10 at a time, 12 chickens in the back, this dog pit bull in between my legs that I'm bear hugging, trying to make a phone call without spilling my rosé that our neighbors had brought, and calling in my new neighbor. It's like, hi, I think I'm your new neighbor. I have your dog. If you can come pick her up, I'm in the purple minivan in front of your house that's full of chickens. Swing on by anytime you can get your dog.
And such is the life of an urban homesteader.
That's a normal day.
It's a normal day here in Silver Lake. So let's talk about milling fresh grains.
One of my favorite things.
Why mill at home?
Okay, so out of all these different activities, some of them I don't really do anymore. Some of them I've picked up some new things, like making my own candles. That was one of the later additions. But while I was making bread, one of my friends who's a super, super, majorly, puts all of us homesteaders to shame. He makes houses out of clay and straw.
Oh.
He makes cob houses.
Yeah.
And designs them and makes... And so, he came to visit us and said, try this apple. And I was like, great, this is so good. He's like, I made it with... I composted my own dung. I was like, could you have told me that before I ate the apple?
This isn't Ray Serino, is it?
No.
No, someone. I'm like, I know someone who did that.
So he looks at me and he sees that I'm baking bread. He's like, Rue, why don't you mill your own flour? And I thought, that's crazy. Who mills their own flour? I don't have room for a donkey to mill stone in my backyard. That truly was my absolute first reaction. And he says, no, I'll show you. Here, we'll just get on the internet. I'm like, ooh, he can use the internet. So he's on the internet, and he shows me this beautiful Beechwood mill, which is that one right there.
So that's a Como?
That's a Como mill.
A Como mill?
It's made in Austria, and that one happens to be the one that both rolls oats and stone mills flour.
Oh, we're going to talk about rolling oats in a minute.
And so I bought it, and I looked up a recipe and said, okay, now I can make whole wheat bread, and I can just buy grains online. And little did I know that everything about that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I was buying yeast in the store.
Mm-hmm.
I was buying grains online, which is a tremendously risky thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And all the recipes I found online included bread flour, like refined bread flour.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a sort of a watershed moment for me. I was like, we don't even define, whole wheat bread as something that is all whole wheat. Like,
yeah.
It's hard to, and also it's hard to do. So after reading a bunch of books and making a decision that I have a mill, so why would I use refined flour? That seems crazy. That's like making your own homemade soda and like buying corn syrup to mix with the cane sugar. It's like, why would you do that? But it's a thing. Bakers do it. Professional bakers do it. Artisanal bakers do it. And I think it's because people have a take. They want that fluffier, lighter bread, but they're missing out on a bread that doesn't have that industrialized, like wimpy, like refined flour, like flavor to it, which I now find disgusting. You can have the best bread baker in the world, but if you use crap ingredients, I notice it and I now taste it. Like, I'll taste bread and think, oh, they use refined flour. Like, what a waste.
Yeah.
All those wonderful grains in here, but then they spoiled it by putting in. Anyway, So I started learning how to make bread from 100% whole wheat. There was a challenge. My wife gave me a challenge. She's like, if you're going to mill your flour, try making bread with 100% whole wheat and don't sift it. And separately, I started learning about fermentation and natural starters and thought, I'm going to do it from a starter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized there's a challenge in here. Can I make a really delicious loaf of bread that is not that hard to make that my kids will eat?
And your kids are young.
They were at the time 3 and 8.
Okay.
And it took me a little while because I couldn't find any recipes. Every recipe had some white flour in it, which was crazy. So eventually I just, in frustration, literally just took all my books, got them out of the kitchen, sat down with a 50-pound bag of hard white wheat berries from a supplier that I trusted because I had gone through so many different grains. Sometimes you get rocks. Sometimes you get all kinds of weird stuff, gross things. And I thought, I'm just going to start from scratch. And based on just sort of my general idea of how bread is made, I'm going to see if I can teach myself from scratch how to make bread from just hard white wheat berries and salt water.
Mm-hmm.
Figuring humans have been doing it for thousands of years without the help of Google. And I happen to have a mill and a scale and a pencil and a calculator, and I can do it all.
Yeah.
So it took a little while. It actually took a few years. But that challenge has now resulted in a bread class that I use a recipe that I developed, which is a 15-minute recipe in terms of like the active labor you have to put into it. And it's really resonated with the community. I mean, one of the other stories that I tell in class is way back when I was getting into baking, one of the things that kept me going was I came down for breakfast one morning, and at the time when my sons were 3 and 8, I said, what do you guys want for breakfast? And they said, we want daddy bread.
Mm.
I was like, I didn't bake this week. There's no daddy bread. And they both started crying. I know they hate it when I tell that story because they're like, I don't think we cried. I'm like, I know
we
you did.
Not
because
cry.
It was a moment for me. It was like, when I was a kid, my mom couldn't get me to eat whole wheat bread.
Uh-huh.
Why? Because whole wheat bread was disgusting.
Yeah.
It's made with rancid flour.
Right.
And I'll do a demo so you can taste the difference with the oats.
Yeah.
So you can kind of experience the difference between fresh and old flour or fresh and old grains. So I swore that moment I would never not have bread in the house that was 100% whole wheat, that's at least available. And then their interest, comes and goes, and sometimes they want it, sometimes they want to go out and get a sub. That's fine.
Yeah.
But they now have a taste for real bread.
What else do you make them?
Well, when it comes to grains, everything. Pancakes, waffles, crepes, cinnamon rolls. Pasta.
Mm-hmm.
I make buckwheat noodles. I make soba noodles from buckwheat. And I just mill fresh.
Oh my gosh. There's definitely a book in this.
Right?
Yeah.
Soka, or also known as farinata, which is a chickpea quick bread.
Mm-hmm.
Dutch babies.
What Dutch babies? What's a Dutch baby?
It's like Dutch gravy is like a batter with egg, and you pour it into a preheated cast iron skillet.
Oh, okay.
And it bakes, and it kind of pops over a little bit, like almost like a giant Yorkshire pudding.
Okay.
So, and here's a great story that I just remembered: the freedom of having a mill. It seems weird to take on that challenge. But I was reading an article about how strange it was that Aunt Jemima, the founder of Aunt Jemima, used a slave icon as their logo, as their mascot. Because at the time, it was like right after the war.
Yeah.
The Civil War. Way back then.
Way back.
And in the process, I thought, okay, that's interesting. That's really cool. But as I was getting down to the article, I saw they had a photograph of his original handwritten Aunt Jemima pancake recipe from 18-something, 1887 or something. Uh-huh. I don't remember the date, so don't quote me on that. And I could read his handwriting, and it said, 500 pounds of hard red spring wheat.
Oh.
500 pounds field corn.
Oh.
And I thought, it's half and half corn and hard red spring wheat. I had whole corn and hard red wheat in my house at that time. I didn't even finish the article. I ran and got it, and I milled the corn and the hard red wheat together and made... That was a turning point for me when it came to pancakes.
Best
it was like,
pancakes,
that's the so best pancakes ever. It was so good. And now I just mix all kinds of grains into pancakes. Sometimes I'll do like a 10-grain pancake, and I'll mix in like forbidden rice and purple barley and a lot of teff and buckwheat. And I mean, just throwing whatever
outside the box,
just totally outside. And it just is a sort of sense of freedom to be able to just mill all that. And the cool thing is there's no waste. This is the cool thing about milling. It's
right.
No waste. You can have all these grains, and if they're stored properly, they will last. I always tell people in class, I think it's really funny. They ask me, how long will the grains last if I buy a 50-pound bag? Because that's crazy. That's a lot to have. I'm like, oh, well, it won't last more than like 8 or 9, maybe 10,000 years. And they're like, what? I was like, think about it. They're living seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep them cool and you keep bugs away...
Then you're good.
In other words, just throw them in the freezer.
Right.
They're good forever.
Yeah.
They're good as long as your freezer is still plugged in.
Yes. And I want one that you can put the bodies in, you know, that kind of a freezer
I
to store the 50-pound bags. See, you and Dana Morgan, who I've also interviewed for this podcast, have that kind of freezer, and it's so you can put 50-pound bags of a bunch of different things in there. And I'm relegated to the 5-pound bags in the freezer because I have a regular refrigerator.
I got it when I got a quarter cow from the CSA.
Okay.
But I'll tell you another little tip. If you have that kind of a freezer,
yeah,
you have just become a sushi restaurant. Because...
What?
You're like, what is he talking about?
Wait a minute.
I used to go into a store and say, can I get sushi-grade fish?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this sushi-grade fish? And I always thought, and I was a fisherman. I fish with my brother all the time. Sushi-grade is not a freshness thing.
Oh.
It is, has the fish spent enough time at a low enough temperature to kill the parasites? And there's FDA guidelines.
Ah.
Those types of freezers get to that temperature, so you could just go buy a piece of fresh salmon at Costco or wherever, wrap it up really tight, pop it in there for a week, and now it's sushi grade.
Oh.
It's like a process rather than a freshness thing. It's like kosher or whatever. So I get tuna steaks, salmon steaks, and butterfish, which is also known as black cod, at Costco, wrap them up, put them in there for a week, and then we have these amazing sushi parties where I make all kinds of...
You're whispering. It's like it's a secret.
It's so amazing. I'm so excited about it.
Oh my God. That's amazing. So that's really information. I mean, that's information I think not many people have.
Well, one of the things that I love about this homesteading is as I learn these different skills and learn these different things, there's overlap.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think is really cool.
Yes.
You learn about fermentation if you're making kombucha, you know, or if you learn about sauerkraut, now you know about kimchi automatically. And then you realize, oh, beer and wine and mead and sourdough, they all have a lot in common.
They're all together, yeah.
And I have the freezer for the beef, but then now I keep my grains in it, and I'm like, oh, now I can make sushi in it. You know,
right.
It's just all...
It all
I don't ferment my fish, though. I haven't gotten that far.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to go there with you on that. So, at a Los Angeles Bread Baker social hour that you hosted here at the King's Roost, I was fortunate enough to win a mock mill, the one that attaches to the KitchenAid mixer. You have got one on the shelf over there.
Yeah.
And that one is $199, which is really inexpensive as far as mills goes. It's really affordable. It's a great starter mill for those who are looking to start milling their own flour at home, especially if you already have a KitchenAid Mixer.
Yes.
But you have so many others on offer as well. Can you share some of your favorites and what you like about them?
Yes. Well, there are a lot of different milling brands around.
Mm-hmm.
Milling is one of the oldest professions on earth.
Yes.
I actually looked up the last names, the most common last names in America, and I know I keep going on these weird tangents, but I'll get back to the topic. The most common one, obviously, is Smith.
Okay.
Because the metal Smith.
Right.
But the next most common American last name
is Miller.
Is Miller.
Yay!
That's associated with a profession. And most notably, I noticed it comes before Baker.
It has to, because the Miller always comes before the Baker.
That's right. So that being said, there are a lot of mills out there. People have been milling forever. You know, hand milling, doing it with like mortar and pestle type tools, and or even just like stone mills of the same design but hand cranked, going back literally thousands of years.
With the donkey.
And the donkey.
The aforementioned donkey. Right.
And you know, you think about the Dutch windmills and the water wheel mills and all around New England and things like that.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of brands out there. So when I first opened the store, I did research what were the best brands. And of course, my friend who pointed that Como mill out to me,
mm-hmm.
I did the research and realized, okay, that's kind of like the gold standard for mm-hmm. mills, but they're very, very expensive.
Yeah.
And Mock Mill is a new company that is, their goal is to make mills accessible to everybody. And that's what I am all about. I think everyone should have a mill. It is so liberating. It makes you feel so powerful to go into the supermarket and see this entire aisle of bake mixes.
Yeah.
And realize they're sitting out unrefrigerated. Flour is a perishable food.
It is, I know. The fact that they're not in the freezer is like, right. It's crazy to me.
So I could look down that whole aisle and realize I can make more than what's in here. And mm-hmm. I can make it with grains I have that they don't even sell in the supermarkets because, of course, I source from local farms and I get some weird eclectic grains and things like that. But so I, in my research, realized Como's really a good quality mill. They have the best warranty on the market, but they're expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an expensive cabinet, and it's made from sustainably harvested beech wood that's like finished with organic olive oil and all that. So it's fantastic and wonderful. And I was looking at other brands, and when Mock Mill came out with their new models, with their new machines, you know, I'll have people come in and say, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of money. I'm like, the Mock Mill inside, it's basically the same thing, and you can spend about half as much.
Right.
It's not as sturdy physically on the outside,
mm-hmm.
But inside it's this very similar design.
And wasn't the Mock Mill designed by the same person who designed the inner workings of the Como Mill?
Yeah, Wolfgang Mock, who is the owner of the Mock Mill company.
Just the best name ever.
He's the Mock, the M-O of Mock is the M-O of Como.
Okay.
So he split off and he wanted to create, he didn't want it to be like, oh, just wealthy people can have these expensive fancy mills. It's not a luxury item. I think it's a staple item. Like the mill is probably one of the few things in the kitchen that like I absolutely could not do without.
Yeah.
Especially now because, you know, one thing we haven't even talked about is the possibilities truly are endless. You don't just mill flour for bread or cookies. You can mill, I had to make a rub for a barbecue and I needed a particular spice, but I only had it in whole grains. So I was like, oh my God, I've got a mill right here. So I milled coriander seeds and the kitchen smelled amazing.
Of course, it would smell amazing. right, you can do cinnamon sticks and stuff. There are certain things that you can do.
Anything hard and dry, you can dump in there. You have to just break it into small enough pieces that it'll go through.
Right.
But anything as large as, a chickpea or a large corn kernel will go through.
I just did some corn myself that I have grown. It's a blue corn for cornmeal that was a polenta cake that is on the Garden Nerd blog right now. It's a blackberry polenta cake with cornmeal. I used blue cornmeal and it was delicious.
Amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, you were saying.
Well, there's also an Aztec black corn.
Yes, that's what it was. It was Aztec.
It looks like pieces of licorice. I mean, it's jet black. It's actually purple.
Right.
But they also have blue corn, which is like light purple. Like, we could talk about corn.
Endless possibilities.
You can do dry beans.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make pea flour, garbanzo bean flour, black bean flour, as long as they're dry. So any dry grains can go through there.
Yeah, and you can crack oats, and you can crack barley. And
yes.
You
know, all the yeah, you can set them on different coarsenesses. Yeah, so right. You can just crack oats in half and make oatmeal if you don't have an oat roller.
Yeah, and you had a video on your Instagram that showed the three mills right next to each other, and they're all like, rah, just kind of setting out, you know, amazing, yeah. Beautiful, finely evenly milled flour. And I noticed that there isn't any sediment in the bottom, because mine, the countertop one that I have, the mock mill that attaches to the KitchenAid, you know, I have it cranked all the way over, but it still puts out some big pieces at first, and then it starts to...
When you say cranked all the way over, do you have the buttons all the way lined up to the finest setting?
I have it past the finest setting, but probably not. I'm afraid to put it too far to the right.
Take it off the KitchenAid.
Yeah.
And turn the millstone, like as if you were the KitchenAid, to turn.
Yeah.
And you can feel how freely it moves.
Okay.
Crank the dial down until it suddenly no longer moves freely.
Okay.
That tells you that the stones have just begun to touch.
Uh-huh.
Back it off one click, reattach it, and mill at that setting.
You have saved my life.
You will probably get a much finer mill.
I'm so excited.
The tough thing about that particular mill is that you can't hear when the stones are hitting because the noise of the KitchenAid motor drowns everything out.
Yeah, it's loud. And my poor KitchenAid gets hot. But the mill doesn't get hot, and that's why I love it. So we did a side-by-side test because Dana Morgan brought over her Como mill, and I had my KitchenAid mock mill. And hers, we put a pound of, or I forget what it was. I think it was a pound of mill of grains in each one.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a Facebook Live broadcast of this. And hers, of course, was done in seconds, you know,
yeah.
Right through. And mine took a while longer. But her grain was hot and mine was not.
Yes.
So there are bonuses there.
Well, you've also wasted a lot of energy on the KitchenAid side because the KitchenAid motor is a high torque, low speed
yeah.
motor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like spending all this energy like and then the stone is just barely moving. The one advantage is if you turn your KitchenAid off and then turn it back on again, it will still continue to mill.
Yeah.
Some of the smaller, you know, dedicated mills, they have a high speed but low torque motor, so if you turn it off and the grains are still up between the stones, if
it
you turn
won't.
It on, it might not start back
oh.
up again.
So you like the Como mills and you like the mock mills. The
yes.
mock mills are more affordable for beginners or people who just want to get a mill.
Well, I don't think of it as like a beginner mill. I've had people come in and say, I'm just going to get this mill to start. I'm like, you will have this mill forever.
Yeah.
The
okay.
stones last forever. Whether you have a mock mill or a Como, they both have really long warranties. And
yeah.
they do that because they're very simple machines.
Okay.
They basically don't break.
They don't break. And that's beautiful, especially if you take good care of them.
And if you can't afford a mill, there are other ways to mill. You know, some people, you know, when you go to Costco... or wherever they're demonstrating the Vitamix,
yeah.
they always talk about how they have the grain, the dry pitcher,
yeah,
and you can mill in that.
That's
in
what
pinch.
I did first. That's...
I've even milled grains in my coffee grinder.
Oh.
It was terrible.
I'll bet.
Weirdly, the bread tasted like coffee.
Not surprising.
Believe it or not. But that's a burr grinder. Those are metal burrs in there, and you cannot get a very fine grind. And they get even hotter than a stone mill.
Yeah. So I started out with my Vitamix, and I was pretty happy with it. But then I won the mock mill. I'm like, yeah. So
oh, good.
Yeah. And okay. So I'm gonna do the stone tightening thing, and that'll fix that problem.
Thanks.
Real quick question about the oat roller function. Is it because I know that you sell a dedicated oat roller? It's right there. The flick was that flick flack or
the
something?
The flick flock.
The flick flock. And so it flocks oats.
Yes.
And so that's what you see when you see. Rolled oats.
Right.
It's a roller, essentially.
Yeah, you just drop the oat groats, which is just, I mean, I don't know why they call oat groats. Buckwheat they call groats, and wheat they call berries. But it's just the seed with the husk removed.
Okay.
It's the same thing in both cases.
Got it.
So you just drop the oat groat in, which looks just like a wheat berry.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, literally, if I held two jars in front of you, you wouldn't probably be able to tell the difference. I can tell the difference from, like, across the room, and I can also tell the difference from the sound of grinding if somebody's milling the wrong grain sometimes. Like, sometimes I'll hear a customer say, I need this, and then I was like, you're milling the wrong grain. But how did you even know that? That has happened.
That's hilarious.
But you just get used to it. And you just drop it in, and oats are rolled because they have a higher fat content. by a lot. Like, they're like 7% fat, I think, off the top of my head, compared to like 1.5% for a wheat berry. So wheat berry is a drier, harder seed, and an oat you could chew. Like, you could just bite it and chew it. If you run the oats through the stone mill, because that extra moisture content, it tends to cake up and clog if you do it too fine. You can do a coarser oat flour, and because it's such a soft grain, it'll still come out very silky soft. But that's why any of the wetter or more fattier grains, you would just run through the roller and squish them flat.
Okay.
Have you done the oat taste test? We can do that if you want.
Okay. The thing is, in my household, I don't buy anything that's single use. But that's like, oh, I really want one of those. Does it have any other uses?
We use it to squish chia seeds and like sesame seeds and flax seeds for our chickens.
Okay.
So we make like a treat meal, and we just throw everything, all the grains in there, and just break them up. So otherwise the chickens would just eat them and they just pass through
without getting the nutrients from
chickens. Don't have a very long digestive tract.
No, they don't. All right.
But what you can do, rather than get an oat roller, is just coarsely grind whole oat groats.
Okay.
That will change your life. The difference between fresh oats and the dry, stale, rancid oats you buy in the store.
Lots of those.
If anything is going to convince you to mill your own grains, it's that. Do a taste test.
Got it. And I feel like people are probably by now, at least in this interview, convinced that they will want a mill. Real quick, I wanted to ask you about your cooking classes that you teach for locals here in Los Angeles. Can you tell us about that?
We have a number of instructors here. One of the most prolific instructors is Mary Moran. She's amazing. She teaches a very popular pasta class.
Oh.
She even incorporates some freshly milled durum flour, which is what pasta is made from. Some people might be thinking, no, it's semolina. Semolina
is
actually durum.
Right?
It's actually a subset of durum. Durum, it's the wheat middlings of durum is semolina, so it's partially sifted. But she uses some whole grain durum, mills it fresh in class, and says the pasta is amazing. She's even been written up in a few local publications as well.
Cool.
She teaches sort of a whole host of classes, and including like donuts.
I saw the pictures of
the donuts.
The donuts are amazing. I don't even like donuts. I was like, I want those.
I am such a jerk because I'm looking over her shoulder, and I'm in the class. I'm sort of half listening, and after class, I was like, next class, maybe try a little freshly milled spelt.
Oh.
And then the next class she did, and it was amazing.
Amazing.
Spelt is so good. It's such a flavorful grain. It's amazing. Spelt is like a type of wheat that's what American bread was made out of in the late 1800s.
It's wheat's cousin, I've always been told. Yes. Yeah. I love spelt. Spelt breads are delicious. When making the bread, it's a lot more elastic. Like it kind of, it's like
it doesn't build
silly
a terribly,
putty.
Yeah, it doesn't develop a strong gluten structure, which is why we abandoned it and switched over to wheat.
Yeah, crazy.
Way back when. So she teaches that and like a lot of general cooking classes, like turkey class and salads, and like she's an excellent, excellent teacher. I have somebody coming in who's going to be teaching, weirdly, a gluten-free crepes class, which she came to me and she's like, I know this is really weird, but I want to do gluten-free. I was like, look, a lot of people do gluten-free, and sometimes I even mill gluten, because you can mill gluten-free grains. Sometimes I'll make stuff, I'll just, for the heck of it, make something that's totally gluten-free. It's difficult to do bread, but crepes, perfect.
Absolutely.
And so many, like, northern, I'm actually part Dutch, and in Holland we have a thing called puffertjes. And puffertjes are those tiny little silver dollar pancakes you get at like fairs and like street vendors.
There's a vendor of those at my farmer's market.
No way.
Yeah.
So those are made with buckwheat flour.
Okay. Which I think tastes like dirt, but maybe they don't make them that way. I don't know. Anyway.
So,
I digress.
We have a teacher from Naples who teaches some traditional Neapolitan recipes. So he does something called a timbalo, which is a crazy looking thing. These huge tube pastas organized in like a vertical, like almost like a sheaf of wheat, right?
Oh.
And then with sauce and cheese in the middle, and then it comes out looking like a birthday cake.
Wow.
It's like lasagna. It's amazing.
Amazing.
So he does that, and he teaches cheese and mozzarella and ricotta. I've got Hejung, who two different Hejungs, who both teach kimchi class, various different types of kimchi. I also teach some fermentation classes like sauerkraut and kombucha when people ask for it. And of course, soaps and candles, because it just sort of, you know, I like to make them. It fits in there, and I like to make them once in a while. People love taking classes like that, too.
Great. And so bread obviously builds community. It seems like that, you know, back in the day, everyone came together to cook their bread in the community oven. And we in on the west side anyway, and I think there is an east side oven. There's a monthly bread bake through LA Bread Bakers where we go to this community oven in Westchester and we all throw our loaves in there.
Yes.
But for you, you're heading up the wholesale bulk program for people to buy into getting grains and flours. My question here is two parts. So what kinds of grains do people get if they want to join in? And I think we've already covered my second question, which was what kind of grains do you sell here in a smaller quantities if people don't want to get in the bulk program?
Well, I don't want the bulk program to sound sort of like intimidating. Literally, it's just an order form that you could just shop. It just so happens that it's being organized by the LA Bread Bakers, which I happen to be sort of managing at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to come to the King's Juice. But basically, you're just pre-ordering and prepaying. If you're willing to do that, then you're in. You don't even have to be part of the LA Bread Bakers. It's any customer. So the way I see it is, all these beautiful grains on the wall here, I sell at an outrageously high price on a per half kilo basis, in the hopes of, you know, people try them and they, you know, figure out what they like. And once you start getting into the habit and you find yourself buying just like, oh my gosh, I'm spending so much money on grains, then you look on the form and say, you know, I'll just get it in a 50-pound bag. And it's literally like 60-70% cheaper than buying it by the pound.
Right. And you save on shipping because everybody's on a pallet together.
Right. A pallet costs dramatically less to ship than a 50-pound FedEx box.
Crazy.
It really is, because we do 2,500 pounds at a time. And I'd love for people to join in because it's my workout day. When it arrives, I have to unload the entire pallet. Usually
all by yourself?
Yes.
And I know what it's like because I'm moving soil all the time. And 50-pound bags, you know, 50-pound bags of soil is the same as a 50-pound bag of flour.
Right.
It's a lot of work.
It doesn't smell as good.
No,
you might argue with me on that one.
No, I think, I don't know. It might smell as
good. Well, what's exciting is when you pick up that bag of caraway seeds and it's like, whoa, that smells good.
Nice. All right, it is tip time.
Okay.
We've bantered on quite a bit. Do you have a favorite tip that you'd like to share with the Garden Nerd audience?
Well, I think I threw a few tips in there.
You did.
There's the pizza screen.
The pizza screen is definitely a good
tip. That will just up
tip.
Your game, like, a lot.
Yeah.
I think, because milling is my passion, I'll do one general homesteading tip, which is pick one. Pick one thing that inspires you. And do it on a regular basis. Because weirdly, I've found that every one of these activities, the more you, as you get into it, the more you do, the more you realize there's so much overlap.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're really learning the skills. Like, don't go try and say, oh, I'm going to learn soap and candles and how to mill and bake my own bread. And just pick one thing and just get comfortable with it. And that will reduce the intimidation level of moving on and learning other new skills. Because it can be overwhelming. I remember when I first started learning how to make candles. You go online and you say, how do you make candles? And it's hugely overwhelming. There's
the
equipment, what type of candle.
Alone is overwhelming.
I don't know what kind of candle I want to make.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to know that? Container candles, taper candles, like pillar candles, whatever. So just pick one thing. It doesn't matter what it is because you'll gain so much knowledge from that, or have someone show you. Find someone who can teach you, because I think in this age of just doing everything on screens and doing everything, even just like tutorials on videos, I think there's nothing beats just learning from a person.
I agree. And that is a really good tip. I have to say, because my bread journey started with a New Year's resolution in 2016 when I said, I'm going to get over my fear of killing sourdough starter. And I went and took a class from Dana Morgan. And it changed everything. I was like, well, this is so easy. I have nothing to worry about. Why did I wait so long? But, you know, it's so much different than looking at a book or watching YouTube videos. It, you know, and then I showed my brother-in-law how to make bread. And he makes bread every week, and he throws one in the freezer, he slices it up, and it's ready to go. So you're absolutely right. And take a class.
And if dumb primitive humans could do it 20,000 years ago,
we can.
You
too.
Can figure it out. I will give one big quick plug for my class.
Sure.
I was really excited because last year, LA Magazine, I don't know if you saw this on, I may have posted about it a while back, more than once maybe, but LA Magazine, I guess, sent a reporter and took the class unbeknownst to me.
Hidden secret reporter.
And they listed my bread class, my sourdough bread class, as one of the best things to do in LA in their annual list. And it was the only cooking class in the whole thing.
That's amazing.
I don't have a cooking background. That is a little bit braggy, but I'm very
humble
proud
brag.
Of that. It's a humble brag. But it's also, I think it shows how much it's resonating with the community.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I've decided to do is, no matter how hard it is or how unprofitable it is, every time I travel, I'm going to try to put up that class elsewhere.
So you're going to Boston?
I'm going to Boston in 2 weeks to visit my wife who's working there.
Okay.
And I asked the apartment complex, can I teach this class? And they said, yes. So I put it up, and I've already got 5 people signed up.
Excellent.
I put it up, I think, 2 days ago. So there's still space left. I've taught it in Boston. I just weirdly happened to speak to somebody out of the blue who's like, can you come to Rhode Island and do the same class? And I taught it a couple months ago in Orlando at a cooking school, which was embedded inside a public supermarket. So I did that.
All right.
So yes, if anybody's interested, if any of your listeners are out there who are not in Los Angeles and want to do something that's supposed to be a good thing to do in LA, it can also be done elsewhere.
Awesome. And okay, which leads me to my next question, which is, how do people find you?
Kingsroost.com, or they can message me on Instagram. I'm KingsroostLA.
Okay.
On Instagram and Facebook.
Got it. Thank you so much for those great tips, Rue, and for being a guest on the Gardener Tip of the Week
podcast. Thank you so much for inviting me. This was really fun.
This was fun. All right, Garden Nerds, you'll find links to the King's Roost website and online store on gardennerd.com this week. We'll also post a link to Rue's social media feeds and YouTube channel. And I'll try and post a link to that class as well.
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
I think, honestly, this might air after the class, but we're going to put it out there for people to invite you to their town to do that. Okay, that's it for this week. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Visit us for tons of free gardening information at gardennerd.com. Show your support for this podcast and the other free stuff on Garden Nerd by becoming a Patreon subscriber. You'll find us on Instagram and Twitter under GardenNerd1, on Facebook as GardenNerd.com, and of course, our GardenNerd YouTube channel. Happy gardening!